Hello everyone and welcome to episode 12, lots of war and some peace. The last time we left off, the Sultanate's army under Alauddin had seen off a large Mongol invasion at the Battle of Kili. Soon after, Alauddin set out southward to take the fort of Ranthambore. The conquest of Ranthambore had been planned out much earlier, and two generals, Nusrat Khan and Ulugh Khan, had been sent with an army to lay siege to the fortress. Ranthambore had initially submitted to the Sultans of Delhi when the Sultanate was first established, but in the chaos following the death of Balban and the eventual breakup of his Sultanate, Ranthambore had ceased paying tribute to Delhi. The immediate casus belli, however, was that the Raja of Ranthambore, Raja Hammira, had given shelter to some of the Mongol rebels who had rebelled against Nusrat Khan while he was returning from Gujarat the year earlier. There were practical reasons for the siege as well. Ranthambore sat on the vital route from Delhi to Gujarat, and so securing this fortress was important for a conquest of Gujarat. However, as Nusrat Khan and Ulugh Khan began to set up the siege, Nusrat Khan was wounded and died a few days later. This was what prompted Alauddin Khilji to set out south. On his way, close to the fortress of Jain, there was this attempt on Alauddin's life that I spoke of in the last episode, which resulted in the executions of many of Alauddin's cousins and nephews as a way of preventing any further rebellion. Around this time, he also began to organize hunts. Now, you might be wondering why somebody who's setting out on a war of conquest would choose to dally around hunting instead. In the Mongol tradition, hunting was often carried out as a way of practicing war tactics. The Mongols would set out in small groups across a vast area and would progressively drive closer and closer to each other, forming a ring. Over a period of time, the Mongols would surround one area by forming a ring around it, and eventually the ring would shrink, driving animals into the center. As the ring closed in, the animals would be forced into more and more crowded spaces, making it easier for them to be hunted. And at the same time, the Mongols also could practice coordination and their particular brand of fighting, which relied on swift movements, concentration at certain points, and then disengagement and moving again. So it was very, very common to have Mongol armies split up into smaller groups, attack towns and villages, and much like the hunt, slowly narrow the ring tighter and tighter and tighter around one city or one area, driving in front of them refugees and panicked civilians who would then flood up the towns or the city, worsening the food shortages, spreading disease, and more importantly, spreading widely exaggerated news about the Mongol armies, and therefore serving to demoralize the defenders further. So, hunts throughout the medieval period were as much activities of leisure as they were training sessions for military campaigns. However, by the beginning of March, Alauddin had arrived at Ranthambore and set up the siege. Now, those of you who've been to Ranthambore will know that it's a formidable fortress. It sits atop a hill with sheer descents on all sides. It was surrounded by a moat, and it was no means an easy fortress to take. Nonetheless, Zia Barani gives us some details of how the siege was conducted. He states that weavers from across the Sultanate were brought, and they made bags which were filled with sand and then tossed into the moats to fill them up. Siege engines, probably of the catapult type, were built, and interestingly enough, he notes the use of something known as the Sang-e-Mihrabi. We aren't really sure exactly what this was, but from the descriptions of it given by Barani, it seems to have been some sort of a primitive gunpowder weapon. Whether this was a gun, that is to say a cannon in the full sense of the word or not, is yet to be determined. Most historians aren't convinced that these were actual guns, but these might have been some sort of handheld weapons that projected rocks into enemy fortifications. We aren't very sure of this, and there is much lively debate as to whether this was perhaps the first instance where firearms were used. Barani also states that the defenders countered these measures by using Greek fire, that is, inflammable liquids which would be lit on fire and then tossed, which made they were also hard to extinguish, so they would often set fire to anything they came in contact with. That was a great way of destroying siege works and the catapults. They flung stones and fire arrows from within the fort, which caused a great deal of damage to the besieging army. Several months later, however, with starvation setting in, the Rajputs within the fort attempted to make a last stand and were defeated, and the fortress fell to Alauddin. Uluk Khan, one of his top generals, was then appointed as the governor of Ranthambore, while Alauddin returned to Delhi. Now, for a small digression here, this is the point at which many listeners would perhaps expect to hear the word Jauhar come into use. For those of you who are not familiar with the word Jauhar, in Rajput traditions, refers to the ritual mass suicide of the women by self-immolation when a fortress had no longer had a hope of holding out, and when the men prepared for one last suicidal charge against the enemy. The reason I haven't mentioned it here is because we simply do not have any source from the period that mention such an occurrence. Zia Barani, for instance, is completely silent on this. He merely states that Raja Hamira was killed during the siege. He says nothing about the women. And it is curious because something as violent and as something as much of a spectacle as that would certainly have drawn some comment from historians and writers of the period. Nonetheless, there isn't any mention of it. However, oral tales passed on by Rajput bards do talk about Jauhar. Given that these are oral traditions. A lot of them are highly fictionalized accounts. We can't take them at face value. However, there might be some grain of truth to it. Perhaps it is simply a reflection of later Rajput notions of honor and the role of their women in maintaining said honor. So, it is incorrect to automatically state that any time a Rajput fortress was taken, that the women committed jihad. It certainly is something that isn't vouched for by a good many of the sources. Anyway, upon returning to Delhi, Alauddin set about bringing in a number of reforms, which hopefully I'll talk about in the next episode. And for about 3 years, nothing much happened in the military sphere. In 1303, however, he set out once again, this time to besiege the fortress of Chittor. Now, the Raja of Chittor, Raja Samarasimha, had initially submitted to Alauddin's forces when Nusrat Khan had led the expedition to Gujarat in 1299. However, over the years, he had simply stopped sending in the tribute, and so Alauddin decided that this was a good time to remind the Raja that he had some obligations to fulfill. The fortress of Chittor, like Ranthambore, was again quite a well-fortified position, located on a high hill, and the siege lasted several months. However, after a few unsuccessful assaults against its walls, Raja Samarasimha himself decided to submit and agreed to start sending in tribute again. Nominally, though, Alauddin decided that it was best that Chittor be put in more reliable hands, and so he appointed his own son, Kisir Khan, the eldest, as governor, and in his honor renamed the city Khizrabad. We don't really know for how long Kisir Khan remained governor, but what is known is a few months later, Raja Maldev, who was Samarasimha's son, was once again made ruler of Chittor, and he continued to remain a loyal tributary to Alauddin for the rest of his reign. While we are on the topic of the siege of Chittor, it is quite inconceivable that we do not talk about the story of Rani Padmini. As I have already mentioned in an earlier episode, the entire story appears for the first time in the work of a Sufi mystic, Malik Muhammad Jayasi, almost 200 years after the events of the battle. And as I said earlier, it was a work that was regarded as a work of fiction even during his own time. Firstly, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the story of Rani Padmini, it goes something like this. In Sri Lanka, there was a king who had a remarkably beautiful daughter. However, he wouldn't let the daughter out, kept her strictly confined to the palace because he was afraid that her beauty would attract male attention. She happened to have a parrot who one day managed to escape and reached the court of Ratan Sen, the ruler of Chittor, and told him about her extraordinary beauty. So Ratan Sen then journeys to Sri Lanka, gets married to her after a display of a feat of bravery, returns to Chittor, and while there, he gets into a feud with one of his neighboring states, Mewar. According to the story, this jilted new rival of his then goes to Alauddin to try and instigate Alauddin to attack Chittor so that he can take Padmini for himself. Supposedly captivated by the descriptions of her beauty, Alauddin set out for Chittor. Ratan Sen puts up a fight, charges out. Depending on which version of the story you go by, he was either killed by his Rajput rivals or he was killed by Alauddin's soldiers. And Rani Padmini commits Jauhar. Needless to say that this is completely different from the accounts of the siege that we have from its own time. Firstly, we don't have the mention of any Raja by the name of Ratan Sen. Secondly, the siege of Chittor did not end in a final fatal charge by the Rajput. Instead, it was a submission. We also know that Chittor eventually was restored to the same Rajput dynasty and they remained loyal throughout the reign. And of course, no textual evidence whatsoever that Rani Padmini was ever a real person. So I think it would be reasonable to say at this point that this was a purely fictional work. The entire story is fictional and should not be regarded as historical truth. The Siege of Chittor, pretty well documented in other sources, does not have any resemblance to the story. That being said, we return to the narrative where just as Alauddin is winding up his siege in Chittor, his old friends make an appearance again. Back in at the end of 1299, when the Mongols had first when the Mongols had invaded, the second in command after Kutluk Khwaja was a general by the name of Taragai. In 1303, having heard that the Sultanate's armies were away at a distant fortress, Taragai decided that he would try his luck at taking the city of Delhi again. In a series of forced marches, he arrived at Delhi much earlier than would normally be expected for a Mongol army and began raiding the outskirts of the city. Hearing of this, Alauddin rushed back north, but having left many of his soldiers back at Chittor, did not feel confident enough to face the Mongols in open battle. So for several weeks, the army of the Sultanate sat held up in the fortress of Siri, while the Mongols besieged Delhi and raided its suburbs. And, for reasons not entirely clear to us, Taragai decided to retreat. Some have argued that this was because, in their haste to get to Delhi, the Mongols had not prepared for a long siege. And others have argued that this was because in Central Asia at that time, there was another war that had broken out, and so Taragai was recalled to help with that. Whatever the case, at that time, this was regarded as nothing short of a minor miracle. 2 years later, though, the Mongols were back. This time, they crossed the Yamuna, the bridges over the Yamuna being surprisingly unguarded, and reached into the Ganga Valley, raiding as far away as Awadh. As they returned, though, laden with their loot, they were ambushed by forces of the Sultanate. And although many of them did manage to get away, nonetheless, they did not escape completely unscathed. The same year, an expedition was undertaken to the rich province of Malwa. So if you're wondering where Malwa comes, Malwa is that narrow strip of land that's sandwiched between Gujarat in the west, the Deccan in the south, and the Indo-Gangetic plains in the north. This was a fertile area which was agriculturally rich. It was also an area known for elephants, which at this time began to play more important roles within the Sultanate's armies, and it was wealthy. Since it also sat at the crossroads from Gujarat to Delhi and from Delhi to the Deccan, it was naturally a very strategic province to take. Malwa fell fairly easily, and Ain al-Mulk, the uncle of Zia Barani, the same one who had lectured Alauddin about the follies of thinking of himself as a world-conquering Alexander and starting a new religion, was appointed as governor here. The next year was another conflict. Once again, Taragai decided to try his luck in a raid. This time, the Mongols advanced, found the bridges over the Yamuna unguarded again. They crossed over and set about plundering the Ganga Valley. This time, though, the bridges had been deliberately left unguarded. As soon as the Mongols had crossed, the Sultanate's armies then reoccupied the bridges, basically cutting the Mongols off and trapping them in the Ganga Valley. As the Mongols attempted to return to their homeland, laden with the loot, the entire army was ambushed and completely annihilated. This was the last major raid the Mongols would attempt on India. There were minor raids, but that is for a future episode. Interesting note here, though, is in the aftermath of this, the governor of Punjab was entrusted with the task of keeping the Mongols at bay. He was a certain man named Ghazi Tughlaq, whom we will come back to in a later episode, because he's going to play a very, very important role in our story. And he made his name as a general leading armies against the Mongols. Not only did he keep Mongol raiders out, he carried out counter raids into Afghanistan, reaching as far as Ghazni. In 1309, 3 years later, Sivana, which is around 80 kilometers southwest of what is today Jodhpur, was taken after a siege of nearly 5 years. So the siege had been ongoing right from 1304, around the same time when the siege of Chittor ended. Again, some authors tend to talk about how the women committed Jauhar, and once again, there is simply no evidence to suggest that this happened here at all. Finally, in 1310, the final conquest of Gujarat was undertaken. Now, many accounts state that Gujarat was conquered in 1299 during the first expedition led by Nusrat Khan. However, epigraphical evidence from Gujarat do not confirm this, and even Zia Barani's account of it is a little muddled. Scholars today believe that there were in fact two expeditions carried out to Gujarat, the first in 1299, which was only a raid meant to seize as much loot as possible. The expedition in 1310 was the one of conquest meant to establish Sultanate authority over Gujarat. The campaign was a success, and Alp Khan was left as the governor of Gujarat. Alp Khan was one of Alauddin's brothers. One point here, though, is that the Raja of Gujarat, Karan Dev, managed to escape and fled to the Yadava court at Devgiri. This would be the excuse Alauddin would use to begin his Deccan conquest by an attack on Devgiri. The start of the southern campaign and the rise of a certain Malik Kafur will be the topic of the next episode. Before we go, though, I'd like to add that this whole period was not only one of conquest, but also one where a number of rebellions broke out throughout the Sultanate, including one in Delhi itself. So Alauddin spent a great deal of this time simply putting down rebellions and, well, executing more of his male relatives. He also undertook a number of administrative reforms, as I already said at the beginning of the episode, which we shall deal with later so that we can keep the narrative flow going. In the next episode, we will talk about the conquest of Devgiri and the Deccan expeditions, and we shall also see how Alauddin entered the third phase of his rule, the first two being one where he relied entirely on his close family members and early supporters. The second, the phase we spoke of today, where many of these early supporters were either killed or died during the course of battle. And so Alauddin began to rely on a cadre of bureaucrats who were not from his immediate circle. And in the third phase is when Alauddin comes under the influence of his slave Malik Kafur, which historians of the day consider to be the part where things started going pear-shaped for Alauddin. So that's in the next episode. Thank you all for listening, and see you soon.